Good afternoon. My name is Caitlin, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Diabetes and Disasters conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Before we begin, please take a moment to answer the polling question on the right side of your screen. Thank you. Laura Reynolds, you may begin your conference.
Thank you. On behalf of Healthcare Ready, I'm pleased to welcome you to this virtual roundtable on diabetes and disaster. My name is Laura Reynolds, and I will be facilitating today's conversations after the presentations. Nicolette with Healthcare Ready, who is going to be providing some context for today's conversation.
Good morning, afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. In today's roundtable, we are first going to start with a brief introduction of who we are and why we care so much about having these conversations. We're then going to have a few of our colleagues who are experts in this space provide us with some information around the overview of needs of patients with chronic disease and specifically patients with diabetes during disasters. Then we'll look at some best practices. We'll look at the CASER program as an example of a best practice for networks and being able to make sure that healthcare is prepared in responding to events. And then we'll also have one of our colleagues at HHS telling us more about the Empower Initiative as another best practice. And after that, we will open the floor for discussion and then think about some great next steps. My name is Nicolette Lewis-Saint. I serve as a Director of Programming for Healthcare Ready. And this Laura Reynolds is who also does have the best headshot I have seen in a while. Will be our facilitator, and she is the owner of LARC Consulting. And our expert speakers are Pam Allweiss, who's a medical officer for the CDC's Division of Diabetes Translation, Keely Smith, who is a manager at the Kidney Community Emergency Response Program, CASER, and Kristen Finney, program manager for HHS's Empower Initiative. A little bit about Healthcare Ready. I am looking at the participant list, and thank you again for all of you who joined us. And some of your names sound very familiar, and some of you are new to us. And so I just want to take a second and tell you a little bit about who we are and why we exist. Healthcare Ready really is proud to serve as what we like to think of as the bridge between the public and private healthcare and public health sectors. And so the fact that we think about a lot is that 92% of the healthcare sector is actually owned by the private sector, which includes the supply chain. And we have about 3,000 jurisdictions in the United States when you think about cities and counties, and hundreds of NGOs. And so our current healthcare environment has a lot of experts at a lot of different levels. And what we know is that in order to make sure that resilience is a big part of what we do in healthcare and that we're continuing to build links between communities, public health, and healthcare, we need to make sure that there are intersections between sectors in advances of disasters. It's even more true during disasters and disease outbreaks. Healthcare Ready essentially operates with two faces, one of them being our disaster response capability, and we also do a lot of work on policy and programs during what we like to call peacetime or normal healthcare operations when disasters are not going on. We have actually responded to more than 60 events. I believe the number is closer to 70 at this point in our 10-year history across a range of different types of events, including infectious disease outbreaks, natural disasters as well. And we're proud to continue to be able to support public health and healthcare during emergencies and making sure that we are able to help the helpers. This is just a quick example of some of the types of things that we've done in the past and some of the ways that we look forward to working with you all. We have, for example, partnered with CDC and NATO to develop a program for pandemic text messaging. We have, on our emergency response side, done a lot of coordinations of medicines and medical supplies for a number of responses as recently as actually the Baton Rouge flooding. We also work with HHS's Critical Infrastructure Protection Program on issues like private sector access to disaster sites to ensure that healthcare operations can continue. One of the most important things that I think that we do is actually during disasters, we will activate our Rx Open Map, which is an interactive map that shows the status of pharmacies in a location after disaster so that patients, emergency managers, and providers actually know where to direct their patients so that they can get medicines and prescriptions refilled. So the next polling question that you will see come up in a minute is a question of vulnerable populations. We'd like for you to take a second and answer that polling question. We'll keep it up for a few minutes. But what we'd like to know is which of these, and you can answer as many as you'd like, which of these vulnerable populations is of greatest concern to you, your community, or your organization? So now I will turn the floor over to Pam Allwise. Dr. Allwise is a medical officer at the CDC, and she'll be giving us a great overview of chronic disease patients and vulnerable populations during disasters and emergencies.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be talking about one of my favorite topics. And I met the folks from Healthcare Ready a few years ago when we were doing a conference on the need for medications for people who have pre-existing chronic diseases. I'm going to be talking about diabetes because diabetes is a model for chronic diseases. We have an epidemic of non-communicable diseases, and if we want to increase resiliency, we have to deal with these pre-existing chronic medical conditions. We know that during a disaster and after, people who do have pre-existing chronic medical conditions like diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, et cetera, have increased morbidity and mortality. And often it's their medications that have run out or they don't have enough or they're taking it incorrectly or whatever. And the conditions created by disasters contribute to the inaccessibility of some of the medications, the right care, et cetera. So that's why we're talking about this, because we really want our communities to be more resilient, and we have to be sure that we include these folks in our preparedness efforts. Next slide. We know that older people whose health might already be compromised will have more problems, and we know that they also have an increased burden of chronic medical conditions. We know if we get people at the planning table early, some of our decisions can improve outcomes. Again, I'm going to give you an example of after Hurricane Charley. This was published in MMWR. 3 days after, people came in to do an assessment, food, clothing, shelter, etc. And it turned out that in this area of Florida, there were many, many older people with chronic medical conditions. They didn't ask about their meds until about 10 days later. And they felt that if they had asked earlier, if this had been in the planning, that there would have been better outcomes. The other thing is, when we're dealing with people who have chronic medical conditions, such as diabetes or asthma, we have to teach them a lot about self-management skills. We teach them about how to take their inhalers, how to take their insulin or their pills. We teach them about diet. We're trying to work with the people who teach self-management education to include modules about disaster preparedness. What do you do when the lights go out or if the power goes out? So it should be part of self-management education to make people more resilient. Next slide. Now, one of the big problems over the years has been the definition of, quote, vulnerable populations. We have all kinds of terms, people at risk for what? Well, for increased morbidity and mortality at times of disasters. So these people are more vulnerable. Whatever term you want, PAPA in the beginning, the Pandemic and All Hazards Preparedness Act, had some definitions. also people with limited English language skills, just like the little poll that we just took, senior citizens, children, people who were physically or mentally disabled. But the problem was that there were many people who had pre-existing chronic medical conditions who weren't disabled. They weren't physically compromised, but at the time of a disaster, if they didn't get their meds, they would be. So people with chronic conditions might fall through the cracks. Where is the person who's 28 years old with diabetes, who doesn't have complications, or the 45-year-old person who has seizures, and they're not disabled until they are without their medications? So now in some of the National Preparedness Action Plans, et cetera, we are including people with pre-existing chronic conditions, and this has been a major breakthrough. Next slide. We also know that in many of the areas that may have had disasters in the past, like when Katrina happened, there was a very huge burden of chronic medical conditions. But it was Katrina that really brought to the public the plight of people with diabetes and heart disease. We would see people saying, oh, you know, I have diabetes, I don't have my medications. It brought a face to the problem. But when you go back and you look at the prevalence of some chronic conditions, including diabetes, before Katrina, you can see that a huge percentage of people had diabetes, had angina, coronary artery disease, had hypertension, or asthma. So that if we look at our the prevalence of chronic medical conditions before, it might help us be more resilient. In fact, in 2010, CDC's preparedness group every year has like a state of the states and what states are doing for preparedness. And in 2010, they actually, for every state, put a table of the percentage of people who had diabetes, asthma, and heart disease, because their saying was a healthy population is a more resilient population. So they wanted people to really acknowledge, okay, this is our burden in our state. So as I say, we have these numbers. It will help us partner with the people we need to. Next slide. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't. So we can see that in Louisiana, they had one of the highest death rates due to diabetes in the U.S. I mean, in some areas it was almost 11%. And also in the evacuees, okay, almost 17% of some of these people had diabetes. So we know it was a huge problem. And over 50% of the people had chronic conditions. Next slide. So if we have this information, it can help us prepare. I don't think I can advance. Can you advance?
Sure.
Thank you. So what have we learned from past disasters? I just wanted you to have some of the references and some of the information, because there has been a lot published, whether it's from hurricanes, earthquakes, whatever the national disaster is. We have some documentation of worsening diabetes control, okay? And certainly in older adults, we've seen disruptions in the quality of life. Sometimes treatment is delayed because diabetes, heart disease, et cetera, is considered a chronic medical condition. And when we have our medications in our stockpiles, sure, we have stuff in case it's for anthrax or pan flu, but we probably aren't going to have medications like digoxin for heart disease, insulin for diabetes, or whatever. The other area of concern sometimes has been shelters. I know that we have some special needs shelters, but I'm just kind of looking at some of the literature, and there had been, and these are international studies, there had been some documentation that blood sugars had gotten out of control in people who had type 1 diabetes, diabetic ketoacidosis, and certainly with Hurricane Andrew, insulin supplies were depleted in the area. And this led some folks, especially in Japan, because after the Kobe earthquake, there were many, many papers about the plight of people with diabetes, heart disease, etc. And they also found that the psychological problems in general certainly were increased. But in people who had pre-existing chronic medical conditions, the prevalence of depression baseline is increased, and even more so after disasters. So one of the recommendations was to be sure that when you're doing planning, you incorporate the psychological readiness as well. The other thing was, as I was telling you about Hurricane Charley, that if assessments were made 3 to 5 days after a hurricane rather than 10 to 14 days, some of those medications could have been deployed earlier so that the resiliency would go up and there would be fewer complications. Next slide. Now, one of the challenges is education of both providers for people who have chronic medical conditions and for the people who have chronic medical conditions themselves. There was just something published called The Ostrich Paradox, Why We Don't Prepare Enough for Disasters. And it was published by the Berkeley Greater Good, and it was talking about just people in general who it's not going to happen to them. And certainly we're trying to engage some of the advocacy groups, and I think the kidney world has done an amazing job educating the folks with chronic kidney disease. We're trying to do this in the diabetes world, in the heart disease world, et cetera. Sometimes there are challenges. The other thing is that some of the providers as well, the providers for people with chronic medical conditions kind of feel, well, I'm just trying to control their diabetes, heart disease, or whatever. I'm kind of out of my comfort zone to teach them about disasters. They're not familiar with it. So that it's a problem for the providers to talk about preparedness as well. Certainly, diabetes educators now are keeping it on their radar screen, and this has been a huge help. So when we teach people routine self-management skills, trying to incorporate education about preparedness has really helped. And we try to work with their state and local agencies and community-based organizations during planning to see what they have so that they know the burden of their diseases as well. Next slide. I want to give you an example of what happened in Kentucky because that's where I used to be in practice. Kentucky has ice storms like Atlanta, okay? And a couple of years ago, there was a huge storm, and they wanted to see what the impact was. And they'll look at the damage to the homes, utilities, access to medical care, et cetera. I don't know if it's the next click or whatever. Thank you. What they found was there was a very, very high prevalence of chronic disease and the need for specialty care. They had a lot of people who were on respirators, a lot of people who had diabetes and heart disease. Now, we knew the prevalence of these diseases before, but it was a different world. The preparedness folks knew about it, but it wasn't quite on the radar screen until they did this CASPER study. And over 50% had at least one chronic condition. So when the message was from the folks who did the CASPER report, hey, we need to be more prepared, it really made a huge, huge difference. So we want to keep it on the radar screen. So what can we do? Well, we can bake. I like to use the director of the FEMA disability group. She says we need to bake what the whole community needs. Let's see what our people have. If 11% of our population has diabetes and 28% might have heart disease, we need to know this. CDC is also trying to get it on the radar screen. We have a preparedness course twice a year, the Public Health Readiness Certificate Program, and in the past 6 to 7 years, we have been giving one of the modules on chronic disease and preparedness. We want you to make new friends. For instance, every state has a disaster preparedness team, certainly supported by CDC, but we also have a chronic disease team. So I'll tell you what we did exactly in Kentucky as well. There was an EIS officer, a preparedness person from CDC, whose big thing is to increase preparedness and resiliency throughout the state. We also had the Medical Reserve Corps folks, and we also had the diabetes educator. We got them all together, and we taught everybody about the preparedness side and about the diabetes side. And the great thing was the Medical Reserve Corps ended up with more people from the diabetes world to be on their MRC. So that it's to make new friends is really, really important. So I wanted to give you an example. So if you don't know who your chronic disease person is, find out. We also have to empower people to follow the messages. And we talked about self-management education. We also need to create policies because so often people do not have enough of their own medications. So that, for instance, there's a vacation override for medications. People can go into their pharmacy and say, hey, well, depending on their health plan, I'm going away for 2 weeks. I need more meds. We were talking about disaster overrides so that people might be able to have this. In fact, UCLA disaster, they have a disaster preparedness group. It made a video to educate their folks, well, there's a magic time where you can refill. If you do it 3 or 4 days earlier, after a couple of months, you'll have enough for your preparedness box. We also have to teach people what kind of food to have as well. So these are some of the things that we can work on to make our people more prepared. Next slide. We want to know our population. As I said, you can go to the CDC website and you can find the prevalence of heart disease, diabetes, and asthma, even down to county level, so that if you know your population before, it'll help you get prepared. Sometimes having registries can be very helpful. And the CDC Aging Office has some resources that you can look at, cdc.gov/aging. The other thing is to talk with some of the shelter folks. What are their intake procedures to identify vulnerable folks in the community? So all of these things, all these conversations need to take place before it happens, but to keep people on the radar screen. Next slide. The last thing I want to talk about is that we have messages, I don't know if you can see this, but we tell people, gather your supplies. Be sure you have enough water. For people with diabetes, we say have healthier foods. For people with heart disease, we say watch your sodium, people with kidney disease, et cetera. But we say have extra batteries, a can opener. All the way at the end, it says have medications. Some of our messages say 7 days, some say 4 days, some say 2 weeks. And the answer that many people say, yeah, right. How do we do this? Okay? They can sometimes get 30 days or sometimes 60 days, sometimes 90 days, but sometimes it depends when the disaster is. It might be at the end of the 30-day or 60-day. So that we give messages, but sometimes people can't do what we ask them to do. Next slide. So, and this was another, Ready America, prescription medications and glasses. Next slide. So because of this, a few years ago, CDC had a conference, and we had multiple players from preparedness groups like Healthcare Ready, pharmaceutical manufacturers, health insurance folks, even advocacy groups. We had federal agencies. We wanted to get the players together, and we wanted to look at policies such as vacation override or disaster override. And at the time, it was right after Sandy. In fact, the conference was postponed because of Sandy. And it turned out that we had a speaker who said that they identified a, quote, chronic disease coordinator. They had people going door to door to see if people had their meds. So some of the things that came out of that was know the burden of chronic disease, or education of the providers and the consumers about preparedness, and almost talk about maybe a formulary if you know how many people have a certain condition, maybe have a formulary of certain meds that are commonly used, different insulins, digoxin, asthma medications, et cetera. Next slide. And then an outgrowth of this was something that ASPR has done in the past 2 years, the Prescription Medication Preparedness Initiative, and I put the link on there so you can see some of the things that we have talked about, and Healthcare Ready has been at the table. And then there was also a public-private public-private partnership that just was published in JAMA last month about automatic messaging, working with aspirin CVS. It was before a snowstorm, so the people were contacted, texted, or whatever, to say, hey, do you have enough of your medications? When there is a disaster, often people can go to the pharmacies to get extra meds, but this was before the fact that if they had a chance to refill early or whatever, to go do it. So we're trying to deal with the need of people with chronic medical conditions to have enough medications to tide them over. Next slide. Just wanted to show you where you could get some specific information about people to help people with diabetes prepare. This is on the CDC diabetes website. Be sure people have enough food, supplies. We want people to remember about their feet. If there's any damage outside, to please be careful. We want people to understand about insulin, because I will say providers and consumers often don't realize that insulin is good up to about 86 degrees for 1 month. It breaks my heart when I hear people say, well, our power went out, insulin was in the refrigerator, oh, I have to toss it. It breaks my heart. You do not have to toss it. Insulin pens are good for at least 2 weeks. The insulin in the bottle is good for 30 days, 28 to 30 days. So we have education about this. Next slide, please. So summary, natural disasters that we know have major economic, clinical, and public health consequences. Sometimes people with pre-existing chronic conditions fall through the cracks. I would love for you to make a new partner, make a new friend, and look at some of the websites so you can get more information on how people with diabetes be more prepared. And I thank you. Oh, so when there's another polling question. So when disaster strikes, our normal way of doing things is disrupted. Pick three areas when you think about disaster and individuals that need care for chronic conditions, and then please submit.
Thank you, Pam. Yes, we do have a new poll up, and you can select up to three responses for this polling question. So, Pam, thank you so much for that overview of diabetes and disaster. I've been thinking a lot about this ecosystem that you kind of laid out. So we have the providers, we have the patients themselves, and the caregivers. And I might add to that ecosystem, especially when we're dealing with disaster, responders and receivers. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the challenges that patients or individuals with diabetes present to the responders and receivers, and how we can go about attending to their needs.
Okay. Often the responders and receivers are not familiar with all of the diabetes gear, so to speak, insulin pumps, insulin pens, all the different medications, et cetera. And so if they're in a disaster and the responder doesn't have a lot of information about diabetes, sometimes it can be difficult, because sometimes patients know, sometimes they don't. If you have a kid who has type 1 diabetes and separated from the parents, et cetera. So we've been trying to teach folks some of the chronic disease teams supported by CDC have had training sessions with some of the emergency preparedness teams as well. We like people to have all of their medications, sometimes on a list or whatever, if possible. But I think that perhaps developing a diabetes 101 for emergency responders can help, just what it is, the different medications. But I think educating the responders just in general, not trying to make them into an endocrinologist, but just have a general idea, and then having the responders educate some of the people in the diabetes world about what they need to know. Okay, so this dialogue is very important, very important. And also for folks who do have diabetes, to make sure that their kit, what are the right things that they need? What are the supplies that they need? Because many people do not even have a kit. So we have to make the responder's life a little bit easier as well. The other thing is to educate responders. I would say if we had to teach them one thing, that insulin is still good, okay, in 30 days, to not say, oh, the insulin isn't good. Let's educate folks more about diabetes and the providers. Sometimes the primary care docs aren't aware of how long insulin is good. So everybody who deals with this would need to know this info.
Thank you. So beyond education, what else can we do as advocates for individuals with diabetes and other chronic conditions to, like as you said before, to sort of create the environment that makes supports the behaviors we desire? So we talked a lot about educating patients so they can have the medication and supplies they need, and know what to do if the power goes out, know what to do if they don't have access to a car. But what else can we do to support providers, including pharmacists and the insurers and home health and patients and the receivers and caregivers and everyone in making those choices the easy choice?
Yeah, sure? I think the pharmacists are amazing, okay? And, in fact, I know that you guys have worked with NACHO, et cetera, on the role of pharmacists. I don't think that the primary care providers know what a wonderful resource the pharmacists can be for their patients. So I think we have to educate the providers about this. I think that the home health agencies, often they will have registries of their folks. If they know the numbers of people who might have heart disease or diabetes or whatever, to maybe have some extra medications on hand. Also to teach people about what to do in a disaster so that if they get this message on how they can be self-empowered from multiple sources, we can empower the consumer, the person with a chronic medical condition as well. Sometimes people are even talking about Meals on Wheels, that they sometimes could be like the connector. Often they are delivering meals. Could they help deliver some of the medications from some of the pharmacies that are open, maybe a three-day supply or something like that? Those are some of the ideas that people had thrown around. So to look at some of these resources and how they can maybe deliver some of the medications in a different way.
Thank you. So we've done this poll, and I think we have about a minute left before the poll closes. So if you haven't yet provided your response, so we apologize. I guess you can only provide one response, but if there are other system failures that resonate with you, feel free to speak about them in the chat function. And just a reminder, that chat function is open for everyone. If you select reply or speak to everyone, then you can send out a message to all of the participants. So in addition, so medicine and supplies is clearly one of the top system failures or disruptions that folks are concerned about, but they're also concerned about breakdown in communication and access to healthcare providers and access to community support systems. Do you know of anything going on in these areas? Are you also concerned about these failures and disruptions?
Well, you know, definitely. And one of the a great example is Katrina. The American Diabetes Association volunteers, okay, went to shelters, really helped a lot of people, and they were really mobilized to help educate folks, to be support people, et cetera. It depends, and the diabetes educators as well. So a lot of it is local, certainly in Kentucky and in Georgia as well, in Wisconsin. The local chapters of AADE, the American Association of Diabetes Educators, and the local chapters of the American Diabetes Association have become very involved in working with Medical Reserve Corps, with emergency preparedness. Everything's local. So I think that working with some of these people to give support, the people who are members of the ADA or AADE certainly know diabetes, and as I say in Katrina, there was also a paper on what they did, okay, that they really gave a lot of support. So whether it's chronic kidney disease or asthma, to talk with some of these advocacy groups like the American Heart Association, to try to get them as support people to help others in need can go a long way as well. They often have never seen themselves in that role, so it's like an education for them to see themselves in that role now.
Thank you. Well, we had a question from one of the participants. Do you have any examples of policies that have been adopted that allow prescription extensions for emergency reserves? They're trying to establish that via their state legislation, but they're having a tough go of it. So do you have any examples of model policy or existing policy that they could use?
No, we don't. Okay, it's all been the vacation override trying to model it after that. The biggest thing has been a lot of the laws after disasters that they would allow people to refill without a prescription. That's been a model for many, many states, okay, but not pre.
Good, thank you. All right, so we're going to move on now to two examples of best practices. We're going to move on now to two examples of best practices from the field. So first up will be Keely Smith. So Keely, I invite you to share with us.
Yes, thank you so much. I appreciate everyone taking the time to come out today and listen to us. I'm going to be providing an overview today of the Kidney Community Emergency Response, or CACER, program. Today's presentation, we will provide an overview of our history, mission and visions, the objectives of our program, and the activities that CACER does to support the kidney community. Next slide.
Give us 1 second. We're closing the poll. Keely, feel free to continue.
Okay. So the CACER program is under contract with the Center for Medicaid and Medicare and Medicaid Services to provide technical assistance and resources to the end-stage renal disease networks, kidney organizations, and other groups and stakeholders to ensure timely and efficient disaster preparedness, response, and recovery for the kidney community. The first National Disaster Summit for the kidney community was held in Washington, D.C. in January of 2006, and the CACER program was formed during that summit in an effort to minimize disruption to dialysis and transplant services during emergencies. So the CACER program is made up of partners from across the entire kidney community. It includes patients and professional organizations, different provider types, hospitals, ESRD suppliers, the end-stage renal disease networks, different state emergency and state survey agencies, and then federal agencies, including CMS. And the CACER program continues on an annual basis to hold a summit that promotes emergency preparedness within the kidney community. Next slide. So the mission for CACER is to develop, manage, and maintain a coordinated preparedness and response program for the kidney community. And we accomplish that by serving as the leading authority on emergency preparedness and response for the kidney community by providing structure and guidance that address the needs of emergency management officials and the end-stage renal disease communities nationwide. So our first objective is to coordinate continuing care and access to services for dialysis patients during emergencies and disasters. So the ultimate goal there is that we don't want patients to miss any treatments after an emergency or disaster occurs. Our second objective is to provide technical assistance to the end-stage renal disease networks, kidney organizations, and other groups. Our third objective is to ensure timely and efficient disaster preparedness, response, and recovery for the kidney community as a whole. And then our fourth objective is to incorporate the patient's voice into all activities within the emergency community as a whole. So CASER organizes and facilitates 6 work groups that provide support, guidance, and expertise in the development and implementation of an infrastructure to support the dialysis community in times of emergencies and disasters. So I'm going to just quickly go through those 6 work groups. We have the communications work group, and they improve the use of communication technologies to ensure that information is available to assist the kidney community during emergencies or disasters. The facility operations group cooperates with the planning among a wide variety of dialysis facilities, the end-stage renal disease networks, and community disaster planners, and assists with facility preparation, response, and recovery efforts. The pandemic and infectious disease work group assists in developing and disseminating plans that support the kidney community's ability to care for patients in the event of emerging and widespread infectious diseases. Our physician expert group provides nephrology expertise and management for patients and with kidney failure and kidney transplant patients during large-scale crises. The clinical practice group is composed of physicians, nurse practitioners, certified nephrology nurses, social workers, dietitians, facility administrators, and patients. And this group takes an interdisciplinary approach to emergency and disaster planning and response. And the members serve as resident experts in the different clinical areas. And our training and exercise group is responsible for the development of a training program to enhance the kidney community's response to emergencies and disasters. So the activities of the CASER program, our first activity, it's been a priority for CMS and for CASER to incorporate the patient's voice in all aspects and all activities and encourage a patient's perspective within emergency and disaster planning. So we do that by convening the National CASER Patient and Family Engagement Learning and Action Network. I know that's a long name. So we abbreviate that as the CASER PFE LAN. That is a group of patients that get together on a bi-monthly basis, and it provides them an opportunity to provide the patient's perspective in an effort to improve emergency planning. The group also supports the development of a National Emergency Quality Improvement, or QIA, campaign, and that's done on an annual basis, and those materials are always available on the CASER website. And the patients are also involved in assisting with the planning of our National CASER Summit that's held annually in December every year. The second activity is to provide technical assistance for the ESRD networks, facilities, and to patients. CASER supports the 18 networks in fulfilling all of their contract responsibilities that are associated with emergency and disaster preparedness. We conduct an annual educational needs assessment to determine the gaps and areas for opportunity. And this is done, it's an assessment that's sent out to both patients and providers, and it gives them an opportunity to provide us with information about what emergency resources they are currently receiving within their facility and what areas that there are gaps that CASER can help in developing materials to kind of bridge those gaps. And that's the next bullet, is to develop and implement educational plan that is based on those needs assessments. We then recruit 10 pilot testing facilities that will test those materials and methods. And once we have tested that and gotten responses from patients to see how the materials worked out for them, we then roll that out nationally. And all that, again, once it's the national rollout happens, is always available on the CASER website. Okay. CASER is the national presence for ESRD-related emergency and disaster response, and is responsible, then, to convene and coordinate national stakeholders in an organized approach to ESRD emergency management. We accomplished that by planning, facilitating, and conducting a national emergency preparedness exercise with all 18 networks participate on an annual basis in that exercise. We support network providers, beneficiary groups, and patients and other stakeholders during emergency situations. And then we partner with different stakeholders within the communities and networks, facilities, to ensure that patients have access to care following and during emergency situations. Again, it's a priority for those patients not to miss treatment if there is an emergency or disaster situation. Additionally, CACER monitors the FDA treatment and medical recall notices, and we send those out to the dialysis community, inform them of any recalls or medication recall notifications that could affect that population. And then we gather information from those stakeholders and enhance that program as needed. So how can you get involved? We always welcome new members to our committees and work groups. You can encourage your patients to volunteer as a subject matter expert on our CACER Patient and Family Engagement Learning and Action Network. You can be an active participant in the national campaign and encourage facilities to participate in that campaign. Be an emergency preparedness peer mentor for other dialysis staff and patients, and then become familiar with the CACER website and different resources that we do have available.
Thank you so much. We will take questions from folks for these presentations at the end. So please write down your questions or enter them in the chat box now. And we will hand it over to Kristen to talk about Empower.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. I'm looking forward to tell you a little bit about the HHS Empower Initiative today. So first and foremost, our work in the Office of Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response in partnership with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services is actually looking and leveraging how we can use federal health data and mapping to and data products to advance emergency preparedness response, recovery, and resilience of communities and individuals that are at risk, particularly chronically ill individuals that reside independently in the community. Next slide. So one of the first questions that have come up as a progressively increasing number of individuals are residing independently was many different public health authorities and emergency management agencies and individuals across the communities were realizing that in an increasing number over the years and disasters that many of these individuals that were electricity dependent, meaning they had a piece of equipment that required electricity, whether it was a ventilator, an enteral feeder, an electric wheelchair, at-home dialysis, and even oxygen concentrators and such, were rapidly showing up to hospitals, overwhelming emergency departments, so they were unable to actually many times take in more acute care patients and or struggle to do so and maintain this population that were seeking access to secure power and care and assistance. In the course of them trying to get to hospitals, they rapidly overwhelmed the emergency medical services systems. And on top of that, they also overwhelmed many shelters. Individuals in the sheltering communities from public health to emergency management said that they really didn't understand or know where these people were coming from. They didn't have a really good way of understanding the total populations of at-risk populations in their communities that have access and functional needs. So after numerous events, we said, you know, how could we help out? And one of the things that we came up with is we realized that we have the Medicare program, which actually includes 52 million Americans, many of which that are the chronically ill, older adult populations. About 93% of those that rely upon dialysis in the community is covered by Medicare, and a host of other different populations. So building on our work in Sandy, we were able to do some record-breaking dialysis work to look at what was the adverse impact on a dialysis population that had limited access to their normal provider. Where did they wind up in the ED? Did they wind up admitted? Was there an increase in death 30 days after an event? And we found that that was the case. We also found that preventative measures such as early dialysis, i.e. before landfall, getting somebody in for an early treatment, would give them more sustaining capabilities through their response, as well as implementing their emergency diet would give them additional time. So that way, hopefully within 3 days max, many of the dialysis facilities would be back up online. So building on this, we actually said, what about those individuals with those electricity pieces of equipment? Could we do something similar for them as well? And we found out through numerous engagements with lots of lawyers and a lot of review, we were able to actually look at, for the first time ever, securely disclosing data to a public health authority under HIPAA, which they had never done before, in the event of an emergency. We tested that hypothesis out, meaning could this data be timely and accurate enough to help, one, anticipate and plan for, but more importantly, in the event of a disaster, could we give a list of individuals to a public health authority that may be doing outreach efforts to homes that they could go and check on the individual and or help or provide additional assistance with evacuations. This also came to bear because a lot of issues with registries. Many of them are not consistently updated. They're not maintained. They are used for different purposes, such as electric company registries. Many of them will tell you that they're not for an emergency. They are for explicitly in the instance that they were to go and shut down their power line for the day because they're doing repairs. They use that registry to notify somebody who's electricity dependent. But it's not for prioritization in many of the cases. There's only a few that do that in the conversations we've had across the country at different points in the last couple of years. This information, though, and their awareness of now how many people live in the community has come to a reality that, you know, these conversations between emergency management, healthcare, public health, and electric companies are now starting to come and see that in our evaluating of our communities, is it better to anticipate where these populations are? Do we have the right resources in the right places? And on top of that, are we making more proactive choices than if we turned on prioritization earlier? So building on the success that we had from our first exercise, which we disclosed 611 individuals' names to securely to the New Orleans Health Department, we conducted an outreach exercise to about 200. And of that, we found that 93% of the time they had the piece of equipment, and they were actually very happy to see us. And we did this during a hurricane early season exercise. We also found that only 8 of them were on the electricity dependent registry for the local electric company, and only 15 had been on their special needs registry. So again, these at-risk registries, unfortunately, don't really capture people because they continue to move around or their information isn't continually updated, et cetera. So building on our experience, we actually worked to develop a new power data set for HHS. Using Medicare data, we have, if a Medicare beneficiary is alive during that period of time that has claims for any of these different types of equipment that you can see from ventilators to concentrators to enteral feeding IV at home. And most recently, we added cardiac implantable devices, which are left ventricular assist devices, right ventricular BIVADs, and also total artificial hearts, because this population is rapidly growing. It's now become a potential destination therapy for those that can't get heart transplants. So with the modern technology of the past 20 years, more and more of these individuals are now going into communities where they used to live in hospitals until they had a heart transplant. We also looked at healthcare services. We know that those on oxygen, dialysis, and also home healthcare services are more at risk. Many of them are rapidly thrust into life-threatening situations in an emergency. So building on this, we needed to develop tools. Learning from our outreach exercises, we knew that HIPAA-protected information to go life-saving is great, but in reality, you have to do this in the preparedness environment, anticipate ahead of time, because providing a list of individuals, unless you're ready to do that and you've really built up your planning capabilities to do so, which you really need to have an understanding well in advance of, you really need to have that in the preparedness environment well in advance of an emergency or disaster, notice or non-notice. So we developed both de-identified, restricted, and public tools, as well as in the event of an emergency, we can also do individual to only a public health authority. Next slide. So the first one that has rolled out is right here, and I'm actually happy to announce that we're getting the finishing touches on HHS EmpowerMAT 2.0. It'll be getting a facelift, and it'll be rolling out soon, and there'll be more information coming. But what we did do was we built this as a beta test of this information. So what it actually has is updated on a monthly basis, the total number of Medicare beneficiaries down to the zip code level, as well as the total number of them that have any of those pieces of electricity-dependent equipment or cardiac implantable devices. It gives you a total count down to the zip code, as well as you have the ability to turn on real-time NOAA weather tracking weather services data, so you can manage to operate and see where certain flood outlooks are happening, which is what you can actually see. So back in 2015, at that time, Texas was having severe floods, and you can see that actually in action there. So this information is basically enabling any healthcare facility in a given area, any EMS agency, any private for-profit EMS agency, fire department, sheriff station, et cetera, all the way down to local community partners, faith-based organizations, the ability to start to understand that there's an electricity-dependent population is rapidly growing in this community, and potential assistance that they might be able to provide or bring to bear, which is what happened during Sandy and many of the other emergencies. Many, if they knew that this was an issue, show up and help out in ways that they could, whether it was access to power or other things. So this map has been used nearly over 40,000 times since its rollout in June of 2015. It's been a really successful tool, so much so that we're taking it to the next level. We're going to be adding more hazard data, and we're also building it to try and start to plug in other types of data for at-risk populations that could be considered at a later date as well. So not just focusing on those that are electricity dependent, but others that might have dependencies on medications or dependencies on other health services and such like that, or even human services as well. So next slide. So as you can see, during Hurricane Matthew most recently, we also used this data to work with other partners in our communities to look at how the power outages happen. So building on this electricity dependence information, we also partnered with an inside tool that we have at Department of Energy, which actually collects data on power outages in a given community. So leveraging this piece of information, we're able to see where the hotspots of the highest incidences of outages were at a given moment in time, as well as those that would be dependent upon it. So in using this information, we were able to better anticipate at the federal level alone what things might be taking place, as well as types of critical infrastructure and those in those community independent living individuals would need assistance and such as well. We also leveraged de-identified data sets that are provided to state health departments on a monthly basis. We are currently working on developing a portal that would also provide them with access to it. Currently, we push this data out to them monthly. In the future, they'll be able to get it themselves along with toolkits and resources and such that they can leverage this work and this data and start to expand it and build it more into their uses. One of the major things about the HHS Empower Initiative is that our focus and our intent is really meeting our partner where they are on the spectrum of data and mapping. So if an individual doesn't understand how to use data, meaning they're rudimentary losing it from a program, but they're not a data analytic person, they're not a person that has used maps, they just use Google Maps, we want to meet them there. We want to help give them tools that they can start to develop an understanding for and start to use them. And then as they get better, we can graduate them up to larger, more technical tools that we have available, such as our GeoHealth platform. Which is our main platform that we have that has public and restricted use that has more types of data layers. So the intent of the Empower Map is really to give that first person that knows how to go to Google and say, I want to go to dinner in a restaurant in an area. You can triangulate about three pieces of information and find an answer. So it's readily meaningful, consumable, and actionable. We also create REST services so that our data is portable. So if an individual at a public health department has a GIS system, they can take the data from Empower Map. They don't have to go to the Empower Map and just use the Empower Map, but they can consume that information right now. So it's in their data. It's in their GIS system. They're overlaying it with their own information, so they're ready to go, and they're not trying to do this work ahead of time. I mean, in the event of emergency, they're doing it ahead of time instead. And lastly, we have the individual data that if we were to have to do an outreach response, those in the public health authority can request it through our ASPR regional emergency coordinators and administrators, and they can have a secure disclosure of that data so that they can then conduct outreach to those individuals in their homes. So next slide. Ultimately, what we've tried to do, and we've been pretty successful, and we're getting ready to do a huge rollout of the full maturation of this program. That has been a learning experience and a great role in which we look collectively across from federal all the way to the most local community member, how we have a way in which we can share information that's at the right person, the right tool, the right time, and the right level. And we can ensure that we have a good situational awareness of what the information is. Now, one thing we always impart on is understanding the gaps in your data. So the one thing that we do note and we say is that we don't include everybody. We have Medicare data. We have the entire Medicare population. We also have those that are dual eligible. So the first thing we usually get is a question is, what about Medicaid? Unfortunately, because Medicaid data is collected at the state and there's a long lag before they provide that data, sometimes it could be years to Medicare, the data isn't timely and accurate enough that we can rely on it to say that is Mrs. Smith at that house and with that piece of equipment. We do get, in general, Medicare beneficiaries, 1 in 5 are dually eligible for Medicaid based on their disability or their socioeconomic status. In light of that, we do get a 20% glimmer of those Medicaid populations as well. In our data set, we found that 27% of the 3.8 million individuals each month that are in that data set are dual eligible. So we do have a little higher instance of dual eligible status in our data set. We do encourage state and local partners and community partners to use this as what I call the floor planning scenario, meaning that do not assume it's everybody, but it is a validated data set and a number to start from. Using that information and taking information from your own community that you're aware of through your aging groups, through your healthcare partnerships, through your healthcare coalitions, through engagements with your emergency management, aging services, et cetera, you're going to adjust that accordingly. But it's a good start. Many times people didn't know where to start from. And if you don't know, this is a good start, at least start from in your planning scenarios of your at-risk and access and functional needs. We encourage everybody to think more broadly about those populations because obviously it includes many others that were shown recently in the slide deck before, which is a great slide, an overview of the populations to consider. And I think of this, you know, the one good thing that we do say of this is that when we did the exercise in New Orleans and we replicated in upstate New York to kind of control for regional variability, 93-94% had the piece of equipment, but also consistently we saw about 45%, 50% said, you know, we're going to actually need assistance in the event of an emergency for evacuation. But 50% said they're fine. They had multiple backups. They had caretakers that would check on them. In light of that, we do say that there's some level of rough order of magnitude that in the event you're not capturing the private insurers, the entire Medicaid population, those that are underinsured, homeless, et cetera, there is going to be some sort of a flush, most likely about 50% in the number that you're using if you're using that as a floor kind of planning scenario, not a ceiling one, but actually a floor from your starting level. So overall, most of this data and the tools that we've provided have been able to help individuals from a pre-event planning utilizing the de-identified data that we provide on an updated monthly basis, as well as anticipating what their potential resources needs would be, anticipating where you might need to do power restoration prioritization and socializing that with your electric companies. Because if you have a high concentration and you know that if you can stabilize that population within a day or a couple of hours, et cetera, that minimizes the amount of having to do a large evacuation and such. So it's thinking about how to stabilize those individuals where possible, if it's appropriate and if it's safe enough in their homes. If not, then anticipating ahead of time what you would need for those resources to make them able to get the access to care and services that they would need, and evacuation needs to a shelter and such. It also provides you a chance to anticipate what if you were to do life-saving outreach, where you might need to go, where you might need to prioritize first. For example, in Hurricane Sandy, they didn't know where to go first. They had a large area that was impacted, and the timeline for power outages was going extended into weeks. And the question was, where do we knock on the door first? They had to knock on 37,000 doors. So here there's a chance that you could start to anticipate what that is. Again, taking this information in concert with other pieces of information, but starts to give you a leg up of where you might need to go. Also on how you can actually start to look for triggers in decision-making. In the past, without having really good data, people weren't hesitant to make as quick of decisions because they didn't know what else was coming down the pike for them, what would happen next. So here, being able to give them more information well in advance, they're able to make more informed decisions, whether through their purchases, but also in a response, they can make better anticipations of what they might need. And also communications. One of the huge things that we found is that we also worked with insurance companies prior to, and we did a survey of the preparedness behaviors of insurance companies back in 2013. We had a number of different events in that year. And prior to that, nobody really talked about the electricity-dependent population. We noted that after we did a survey with a nationally representative sample, almost all of them that participated through the America's Health Insurance Plans partnership, we saw a ton of them that actually started to identify the needs of this population and started to call it out in their press releases where they had never done it before. So we've been really encouraged. They've also become more aware of the different populations and how to identify and start to advocate for communications to them prior to an emergency as well. So, and finally, just activating your emergency resources and assets, communicating to your public well in advance so that they understand where to go and what they need, and being how to address some of those needs and as quickly and what the timelines might be. We have a number of chronic conditions that we have timelines before they start to need assistance, such as those that have dialysis dependencies. It's usually within 2 to 3 days. Sometimes they may be able to go 4 depending on their renal diet. And as well as those with diabetic dependencies for insulin and also cardiac medications and such. So we've started a pretty good start. We have a lot of areas and growth to do. We always encourage feedback and ideas on different at-risk populations that might need help and other information that could be helpful from all different levels. And we appreciate the opportunity to tell you about this today. And if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you, Kristen. So I'd invite everyone to take a look at the lower, at the right hand of your screen and make sure you answer the poll. So pick the response that best matches your organization's current status with regard to being engaged in a network that connects healthcare and public health with emergency preparedness and response. So I have a quick question for the two of you. We just heard an example of an organization that's advocating and supporting on behalf of a specific set of patient population, so kidney patients, and from the ASPR's office where they're putting together data sets that could help people respond and plan better. So for the two speakers, how would you use a data set like this to help advocate or plan on behalf of needs of kidney patients and vice versa?
I guess I'll go first. This is Keely with CATER. Any additional information is always beneficial when serving the kidney community. Any mistreatments can cause, life-threatening issues for kidney patients. And something like I was very interested in that Empower map that was put up because without electrical power, if a facility doesn't have backup generators or an availability to get backup power resources, then they can't dialyze their patients. So these resources are very beneficial in preparation and response for the kidney community.
And Kristen, do you have a vision for organizations using these to advocate for larger policy and system change?
Yeah, I think many of the times that the issue that you have is that there's a lack of understanding of the magnitude of populations that have these dependencies and chronic illness. I can honestly say in the past 3 to 4 years, and many years before that in my career, it's gone back many years, but really across in the past 3 to 4 years, this tool has actually started to open communication, particularly with emergency management, that had a different interpretation of what chronic illness was or didn't really truly understand the needs for dialysis patients, et cetera, those that are dependent on different medications and such, and what types of needs they have. So that movement of having this information and having something that they can wrap their brain about and then using it as a tool for engagement. So being able to take this piece of information, everybody has a different part and role in stabilizing this population in their community, right? There's one element from healthcare, there's an element from EMS, there's an element from public health to sheltering to emergency management, maybe doing the lift on all the evacuations and such. So aging services that provide services to many of these people every day. So the data has actually been unifying in the sense it brings people together because they know their own part, but for once they're kind of coming to the table and talking about all of it and seeing that they all kind of have an interdependency. And that's been actually really helpful to move the conversation along, I think, at a faster level. And it's based on the fact that it's data-driven. It's not a number out of the sky that many times we've had to do in the past. As well as the GIS, that a map speaks loud. It speaks loudly to people, and they can see the importance of it. And it's really also giving, I think, help to associations, too, that can continue to advocate for their population. So bringing all these three different pieces together, now you have some data, you have maps, you have advocacy that is explaining it, and I think we're starting to have that translation into how we're doing preparedness, response, and also recovery. I can honestly tell you that, like, FEMA has used this information now for their individual assistance programs. They look to it and say, do we need to anticipate how many people might have a claim for durable medical equipment? So now they're looking at it ahead of time and saying, we might need to turn that on earlier rather than later if this emergency rises to that next level in a declaration. So the other thing is we've worked very closely in the past with CASER and CMS on looking at where those dialysis providers are. We get information. Prior to really earlier than Sandy, dialysis wasn't always recognized in our community as a prioritized provider. You know, we really kind of focused on the institutionalization of, like, hospitals and long-term care facilities, those residential facilities of those evacuation. But now, because people are in the communities and they have dependencies and really dialysis is an outpatient environment, we're also recognizing the needs and the dependencies on that in any emergency. So I think it's actually expanded, and it's helping to move it forward. But again, I just encourage everybody to take the time, be patient sometimes when, especially when you've been doing this as long as you have, to help bring other people along, let them understand, because it takes a little effort.
Thank you. So we're going to bring all of the speakers back into the conversation and also open up the conversation to all the folks who have been listening in so far. So if you have questions, you can press star 1 to alert the operator that you have a question. And you can share your questions and comments via the chat function. So feel free to share questions and comments either of those ways. So I'll ask a question of all four of you. I think it's pretty clear that in order to change behaviors and practices and systems, that you need a combination of data and sort of these individual stories. And it's also clear that there are lots of groups working on behalf of different groups with chronic conditions very effectively, but maybe not. We're less effective at working across all of these areas because a lot of these patients have similar challenges when faced with disaster. So how can we do a better job of
getting a wider lens and understanding of the patient, provider, and frontline challenges and needs, both in terms of data points, and the individual story, so that we can advocate better. And any of the speakers can chime in.
I'm happy to jump in here. This is Nicolette with Healthcare Ready. I think one of the things that we are hoping to do, even with roundtable discussions like this, is to make sure that we're all connecting and getting a better assessment of the resources and the information that is already in existence. And so a big part of this is looking at how resources like the Empower Map and even networks like HACER can come together so that we're not trying to reinvent the wheel or operating without having a kind of a complete picture and really being able to open the aperture and look at all of the potential resources and data that are available. So for us, that's a big part of it. The stories are really important. For one of the challenges that we have sometimes is that depending on the organization, they may not be comfortable sharing the story. And so that's kind of a different issue, but it's related because there are some stories of either challenges that are faced or resources that can be brought to bear that we have to figure out how to de-identify or kind of quietly share between channels so that we can really have a full picture without having to necessarily give all of the details about the organization or the individuals that are in play. So I think there's an opportunity. It's just about figuring out how we communicate more and how we can do a better job of continuing to keep these lines of communication open and sharing information without it being an additional burden.
Thank you. Do other folks want to chime in on that question?
Hi, this is Kristen again. I think definitely the stories help because they put it into context. And I think one of the things that I said is when you're looking at numbers, the numbers may be daunting, but each one is an individual to another person and a family and such, and they all matter. And I think when you can personalize an example and provide that to partners and other individuals that may not be aware of what a chronic condition is, because quite honestly, people don't understand what happens in the healthcare system until they rely upon it in an acute situation. And then they suddenly learn how hard it is and complicated it is for coordination of care. And then take a situation where your healthcare situation is, you know, denigrated based on a disaster. In our case, we were able to see that through a story of an individual that was dialysis dependent, lived in Brooklyn, had his access to his service provider minimized, and he wound up after and had to get dialysis and wound up for 24 hours being shuffled to 5 different hospitals across that area within days of Sandy, and went to one to another that they couldn't support him or provide services, got his dialysis, and then 2 days later had to go through this whole process again. And remember, there's no transportation, there's no resources, and this is a reality. While everybody was trying to come back up online, those stories actually translate to other people. And I think chronic care doesn't always translate to a lot of people. So when you can put it into context of a story of an individual, and you don't have to name that person, but you can give an experience of what they went through, it helps people to put it into perspective. I know, for example, Florida, we did in Hurricane Matthew, we used data in Florida. They rapidly tried to do this for the first time. They were testing a reverse dial to reach out to individuals by phone. And there was a gentleman that indicated and called back and said, yeah, I need some help because I'm insulin dependent. So I think I'm okay, but in X number of days, I'm not going to be okay. So I might need some help in this amount of time. So here's a perfect example of that. And they've nicknamed him Stanley to protect his identity. But Stanley has become a story, and people pick up on that. And then it brings awareness. So I do encourage people to find those stories and then translate it to a larger population so people understand that.
Thank you. So one of the things that everyone's talking about right now is the new CMS rule that enhances requirements and related to preparedness for a range of healthcare providers. It goes into effect this fall. How can we leverage that to help us do this work better?
I'll jump in at Kristen again. I think one of the examples in the rule that's really helpful is that home health care for the first time is included. And some of the requirements that can be found in the final rule is that home health is required to actually look at their patient population and look at their acute care needs and be able to communicate that information to emergency, to their public health authorities and emergency management that might need acute assistance. So for the first time, you have individuals that are in the community. There are some communities, there are some home health that have done this ahead of time. There are exemplars out there that do this. But more broadly, consistently across the entire community, as this role is implemented, this would provide an opportunity to have a broader awareness of the chronic populations and what those needs are and being able to have that direct communication in the event of an emergency. So I think that's another huge leap in many ways that we didn't have necessarily before.
This is Nicolette. I'll also jump in. We've been spending quite a bit of time looking at the rule, and one of the things about the rule, as Kristen mentioned, is that there are about 17 providing organizations, types of providers that would be would fall under the rule. And the reason that matters is because there are a number of organizations that would not typically be thinking about emergency preparedness that are now going to have to be compliant with this rule. Kristen just mentioned home health as an example, ambulatory surgery locations, and also mental health facilities are fall under the rule as well. And so those are, I think, organizations that typically would, because they have outpatient procedures, not really be thinking about a lot of the considerations as it relates to emergency preparedness. So it gives us a great opportunity. I will use this opportunity to also say that I think the dialysis community has historically done a great job thinking about emergency preparedness and how to coordinate. And so there may be some best practices that can be brought to bear. But in terms of answering your question around opportunities, I think the real opportunity here is to better engage with coalitions. And so this may be an opportunity for us to all look at ways in which healthcare coalitions across the country can be used as a resource to help to get prepared for the rule, to do some of the exercise and training requirements that are associated with the rule, because, as you said, it's going to go into effect this fall. And so there isn't a whole lot of time to really get ready and prepare on, you know, as individual organizations begin to think about compliance. But there is, a point of opportunity for the coalitions to really be able to take more of a connecting role and a coordinating role within their local communities to be able to assist healthcare organizations with the rule.
This is Keely. I agree with Nicolette about the coalition. And from the dialysis perspective, dialysis facilities already have the requirement to reach out to their local emergency management. But now with the participation in the coalition, it can give the dialysis facilities and the community a chance to build those relationships with other partners such as public health, you know, the ESF8, and really building relationships with emergency management within the community. And I think those coalitions are really going to help with building those relationships.
This is Kristen just jumping on. I think definitely on all the points, and I really do need to call out dialysis preparedness, because if you go back to Katrina and the amount of progress they've made from taking this approach systemically, clinically, and also from the patient perspective, they've made a significant stride in taking care of their population. And CACER is an incredible program that really does this. It steps in and fills in many of those gaps and helps make those bridges and connections that we don't always realize are so critical. And as a consequence of that, I think I encourage people, whether in a different area or a different subset, to really kind of look at the model that they've developed and see how some of this can translate into the other provider universes and and supply chains, et cetera, because what they're able to do in such a short period of time is unparalleled. We saw it during Sandy. While we still saw adverse outcomes in the population, we also saw early dialysis being coordinated in almost 60% of the population in 92% of the facilities. And that took coordination and effort to bring all those individuals in early and such, and it didn't do it without good preparedness. And I think it was a testament to them, and it continues to be a testament to the community. So I always encourage everybody, check it out and see. We all can continue to get better, but I think they've done a really great job, and they're still continuing to improve.
Thank you. I think we are just at our time, and I know we had a couple of questions, which we will circulate with the speakers just to make sure that we can get those covered for you. But I'm going to hand it back now to Nicolette to wrap us up and talk about next steps.
Sure. I will just take 1 second to make to reiterate a comment that we received, which I think is a really important one. On the ways in which we have, as we're talking about the CMS rule, the ways in which we've been thinking about emergency management for a lot of organizations has been around fire. And so how we actually are able to take what we've done on the preparedness side as it relates to preparedness for fire and translate that into healthcare may provide us with more of an opportunity. I just want to take a moment and thank everyone for participating in this roundtable. Yes.
Before we close out, we did have someone queue up over the phone.
Go ahead.
Stella Sheridan, your line is open.
Okay, thank you. I'm an emergency services planner, and so when the rule was changed in 2008, and I couldn't finish my complete thought before I accidentally hit submit, but and it's regarding the emergency plans. I mean, every dialysis agency was supposed to have an emergency plan. However, it was only fire-centric, and the response was only evacuation. But it was very easy to turn that into an all-hazards plan. But they, I don't know if it was a corporate thing from the large dialysis organizations that didn't see this and didn't explain this to the facility managers. But, you know, I started to get plans to be reviewed that really weren't planned. They were just a corporate approach that said, we have written policies and guidelines. We have written this, or we have written that. And so I got very frustrated because it's my job to help them create a better plan. And then the additional rules, now I've been making those contacts, and we've been doing that since, say, 2010, at least in my county in Arizona. But and we're different because we don't have evacuation routes like some of the Gulf Coast states. And when I hear stories about, like, the man who was going to have dialysis again in 3 days, well, why could, if everyone knew that power couldn't be restored, why did they let him go home? Couldn't there have been some sort of arrangement made? I mean, no one seems to think beyond the current emergency. I mean, how do we make sure he's going to be okay? And another thing is that I hear anecdotal stories about how fire departments can deliver water to dialysis centers. Well, that just isn't going to happen in Arizona. It can't happen, and it wouldn't happen. And they don't have generators, and so they end up closing their doors and sending them to a back, or, you know, the closest person that had power. So,
thank you, Stella, for sharing those stories and examples. I think this is a great
example of why Healthcare Ready wanted to have these roundtables in the first place. We know that these issues are incredibly relevant and important, and there are a lot of people doing a lot to fix them, but we're not always connecting and able to use the best practices and lessons learned from other communities and our own. So that's part of why these roundtables were started in the first place, and I'll let Nicolette tell you more about that.
Absolutely. So thank you, Lauren. Thank you again, Stella, for your comments. I would like to thank everyone again for participating, and I'd like to say a special thank you to our speakers. I think one of the things that our speakers have really pointed out is the importance of working both across sectors, but really across networks as well. They have given us a tremendous wealth of information and resources in this last 90 minutes, and I am particularly grateful. Moving forward, we will be sending out an email to all of the participants that will include the slides from today as well as some contact information. We also have some supplemental slides in the CMS rule that we will share with you all on our website. If you are interested in tracking the rule and opportunities to prepare, there is a listserv that you can sign up for on healthcareready.org. We'll include that information in the email as well. As we also have some additional resources from Dr. Allweis at the CDC that we will include as supplemental slides for you also. We plan to have future roundtables in D.C. If you are interested in participating, if you are local, we'd love to see you in person. And if you are remote, we'd love to figure out ways to make sure that you are able to continue to engage in these conversations about the ways that patients with various diseases can be impacted by disasters. So we look forward to connecting with you all, and thank you, and have a great weekend.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.